So, but I'm not sure. We're one of four classes that got chosen to do this, so kind of nice for admissions. So, anyway, I don't know if it'll be this class or the next, but they shouldn't be. I don't think they'll be intrusive, and they're not doing audio. It's just video. So they'll be walking around in here while we're in class.
Yeah.
Okay, so would anyone like to read? I had asked if someone would read before we left a little bit from Mark Twain. And if somebody would start with that, I'd really appreciate it. It's not a lot, actually. It's about four pages. So you don't mind, Shelby? That'd be great. And then after we do that, after Shelby reads, we'll go right into the lecture. So I'm going to be looking at things. That would have been at Progressive Era, things like the machine that we'll talk about. You'll kind of see that here in Connecticut Yankee. So if you just want to start up.
Yes,
it is now Death to the Republic.
Where, will you tell me when is that?
Oh, it actually. Sorry, Shelby, I should say. Yes, so right at the end of. The box, right by the little mark. So the page before.
Yes, it was now death through the Republic everywhere, not a dissenting voice. All England was marching against us. Truly, this was more than I had bargained for. I watched my 52 boys narrowly, watched their faces, their walk, their unconscious attitudes, for all these are a language given us purposely that it may betray us in times of emergency when we have secrets which we want to keep. I knew that thought would keep saying itself over and over again in our minds and hearts. All England is marching against us. And ever more strenuously imploring attention with each repetition, ever more sharply realizing itself to their imaginations, until even in their sleep they would find no rest from it, but hear the vague and flitting creatures of their dreams say, all England is marching against you. I knew all this would happen. I knew that ultimately the pressure would become so great that it would compel utterance. Therefore, I must be ready with an answer at that time, an answer well chosen and tranquilizing. I was right. The time came. They had to speak. Poor lads, it was pitiful to see. They were so pale, so worn, so troubled. At first, their spokesman could hardly find voice or words, but he presently got both. This is what he said, and he put it in the neat modern English taught him in my schools. We have tried to forget what we are, English boys. We have tried to put reason before sentiment, duty before love. Our minds approve, but our hearts reproach us. While apparently it was only the nobility, only the gentry, only the 25 or 30,000 knights left alive out of the late wars, we were of one mind, and undisturbed by any troubling doubt. Each and every one of these 52 lads who stand here before you said, they have chosen, it is their affair. But think the matter is altered. All England is marching against us. Oh, sir, consider, reflect. These people are our people. They are bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh. We love them. We do not ask us to destroy our nation. Well, it shows the value of looking ahead and being ready for a thing when it happens. If I hadn't foreseen this thing and been fixed, that boy would have had me. I couldn't have said a word, but I was fixed. I said, my boys, your hearts are in the right place. You have thought the worthy thought. You have done the worthy thing. You are English boys, and you will remain English boys, and you will keep that name unsmirched. Give yourselves no further concern. Let your minds be at peace. Consider this. While all England is marching against us, who is in the van? Who, by the commonest rules of war, will march in the front? Answer me. The mounted host of mailed knights. True, they are 30,000 strong, acres deep they will march. Now observe, none but they will ever strike the sand belts. Then there will be an episode. Immediately after, the civilian multitude in the rear will retire to meet business engagements elsewhere. None but nobles and gentry are knights, and none but these will remain to dance to our music after that episode. It is absolutely true that we shall have to fight nobody but these 30,000 knights. Now speak, and it shall be as you decide. Shall we avoid the battle, retire from the field? No. The shout was unanimous and hearty. Are you, afraid of these 30,000 knights? That joke brought out a good laugh. The boys' troubles vanished away, and they went gaily to their posts. Ah, they were a darling 52, as pretty as girls, too. I was ready for the enemy now. Let the approaching big day come along. It would find us on deck. The big day arrived on time. At dawn, the sentry on watch in the corral came into the cave and reported a moving black mass under the horizon and a faint sound which he thought to be military music. Breakfast was just ready. We sat down and ate it. This over, I made the boys a little speech and then sent out a detail to man the battery, with Clarence in command of it. The sun rose presently and sent its unobstructed splendors over the land. and we saw a prodigious host moving slowly toward us with a steady drift and a lined front of a wave of the sea. Nearer and nearer it came, and more sublimely imposing became its aspect. Yes, all England were there, apparently. Soon we could see the innumerable banners fluttering, and then the sun struck the sea of armor and set it all aflash. Yes, it was a fine sight. I hadn't ever seen anything to beat it. At last we could make out details. All the front ranks, no telling how many acres deep, were horsemen, plumed knights in armor. Suddenly, we heard the blare of trumpets. The slow walk burst into a gallop, and then, well, it was wonderful to see. Down swept that vast horseshoe wave. It approached the sand belt. My breath stood still, nearer, nearer. The strip of green turf beyond the yellow belt grew narrow, narrower still, became a mere ribbon in front of the horses, then disappeared under their hooves. Great Scott! Why, the whole front of that host shot into the sky with a thunder crash and became a whirling tempest of rags and fragments, and along the ground lay a thick wall of smoke that hid what was left of the multitude from our sight. Time for the second step in the plan of campaign. I touched a button and shook the bones of England loose from her spine. In that explosion, all our noble civilization factories went up in the air and disappeared from the earth. It was a pity, but it was necessary. We could not afford to let the enemy turn our own weapons against us. Now ensued one of the dullest quarter hours I had ever endured. We waited in a silent solitude, enclosed by our circles of wire and by a circle of heavy smoke outside of these. We couldn't see over the wall of smoke, and we couldn't see through it. But at last it began to shroud away lazily, and by the end of another quarter hour the land was clear, and our curiosity was enabled to satisfy itself. No living creature was in sight. We now perceived that additions had been made to our defenses. The dynamite had dug a ditch more than 100 feet wide all around us and cast up an embankment some 20 feet high on both borders of it. As to destruction of life, it was amazing. Moreover, it was beyond estimate. Of course, we could not count the dead because they did not exist as individuals, but merely as homogeneous protoplasm with alloys of iron and buttons. No life was in sight, but necessarily there must have been some wounded in the rear ranks who were carried off the field under cover of the wall of smoke. There would be sickness among the others. There always is after an episode like that. But there would be no reinforcements. This was the last stand of the chivalry of England. It was all that was left of the order after the recent annihilating wars. So I felt quite safe in believing that the utmost force that could for the future be brought against us would be but small, that is, of knights. I therefore issued a congratulatory proclamation to my army in these words. Soldiers, champions of human liberty and equality, your general congratulates you. In the pride of his strength and the vanity of his renown, an arrogant enemy came against you. You were ready. The conflict was brief, on your side glorious. This mighty victory, having been achieved utterly without loss, stands without example in history. So long as the planets shall continue to move in their orbits, the Battle of the Sand Belt will not perish out of the memories of men. The Boss.
Okay, great job, Shelby. Okay, so I don't know how many of you have read this before. This is an excerpt from the end of King Arthur's Connecticut Yankee King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. And Twain, of course, Samuel Clemens, his real name, had written this, and I don't know how many of you caught it. One of the reasons I had Shelby read what she read is because we're at the end, and the story revolves around this guy named Hank Morgan, German for tomorrow, who is the head, he's the boss of the Hartford, Connecticut Colt Arms Factory. So it's a mechanic, he's an engineer, he's a boss, he's a manager, and he's gotten into a fight with one of his laborers, and the laborer hits him on the back of the head, and when he wakes up, he's standing in medieval England. He's sitting actually under a tree in medieval England. And it's one of the first time travel stories. And it's hilarious at times. So when he arrives, Hank Morgan, when he arrives in England, he decides either one, he's actually in medieval England, or two, he's gone crazy. And either way, he decides he'll be in charge either of England or the asylum within a few weeks. And he wants to be the boss. So this was published. It was written in the 1880s, but it was published in 1891. And Twain has it's a blast for the first 90% of the book. It's hilarious. So when he's trying to get out the competitive urges of the knights, he has them form Major League Baseball teams. So instead of actually jousting with one another, they play baseball, and they've created all kinds of leagues, and they're doing great. But at the end, he realizes that he can't fully convert England unless he wipes out the people who already live. And so he has these boys, the 52 boys that he's recruited, and they line up all kinds of modern weaponry that they've designed, Gatling guns, machine guns, dynamite, electric fences, And the ending is just unbelievably brutal because it's a scene out of the Holocaust camps or the Gulag, what Shelby just read. And I don't know how many of you caught it because Twain's so funny, even when he's writing about dreadful things. But he noted that after they detonated all of this, and it's just the 52 boys and his friend Clarence and himself that are standing there watching, they can no longer distinguish the enemy because the enemy has been blown into nothing but protoplasm. Protoplasm mixed with alloys of buttons. So all the human flesh, all 25,000 of the English knights have just become mush. And it's horrific. This is meant to be horrific. It's not meant to be funny. And so Twain is trying to figure out a lot of what's happening in the modern world. And this is terminology that may seem kind of quaint for a lot of people. For me, it's the kind of terminology I grew up with in the 80s because it was all over popular music, especially rock music. But what Twain was fighting against was a notion of what would be called, at least in the 19th century, the machine. And the machine is anything. So this tended to be a pretty, we now call it a libertarian concept, though that word didn't quite exist in the late 19th century, but it was a fairly libertarian concept. It was the fear that any huge thing, what they would have called the colossal, anything huge would have undermined the dignity of man. So Twain almost certainly had in mind Sherman's march across Atlanta into the sea. So he was probably thinking in military terms, but he would have been just as interested in applying that not to military terms at home, but also abroad. So this is why, and I realize we're now a week out of schedule here because of my illness last week, but if you remember when we left on Monday, we read that great piece called The Eclipse of Liberalism. And the author of that piece and Twain were friends. And there were a couple of other people who were involved in that as well. They called themselves as a group the Anti-Imperialist League. So the Anti-Imperialist League was a group of what we would call probably kind of conservative libertarians who had banded together and they had fought for natural rights rather than for the kind of growing nationalism. So their argument was that all these things that are coming in, they can identify with the machine. The machine is anything that takes Laurel and makes her a piece of the mechanism rather than allowing her to be herself. So she becomes subsumed in this collective entity. So that's, we have to be a little careful because modern day libertarians would be very, I don't think they'd be as critical of corporations as Twain and his group of libertarians were. So anything, government bureaucracy, education systems, corporations, anything that had bureaucracy, they were very, very fearful of, because this is what they called the machine. And one thing that we'll start getting into now, that we did start talking about last week, and where it fits in with progressivism, is the ultimate form of the machine was if we could mechanize ideas. If we could mechanize ideas, there'd be nothing worse. So if we could take an idea and make it somehow this thing that just rolls over you. And of course, we call this ideology. They would have probably called it propaganda. They would have used the term ideology. That term has been around since Napoleon, but they often just talk, they use shorthand, they call it ologies. You find that all over late 19th century language. But it was the fear that you would systematize thought, and therefore man would become nothing but a kind of receptacle for an idea. So even if you're presenting good ideas, it was still fearful that you might present them in a way that was demeaning to someone. So it would be possible for me to take a Jared or a Laurel, and even in my extreme individualism, I could accidentally subsume them into my own thinking of systematizing them, making them less than what they're meant to be, even if I'm promoting their own individuality. So it's the mechanism itself that's very dangerous. I'll try and put it this way. There are a couple of things I'm going to bring up today and some fairly, I think, heady stuff. I hope it makes sense. I'll do my best to explain it well. But ideology, in terms of how they understood it at the turn of the last century, and especially Twain fighting it and what you saw there with the representation of these boys taking on all of traditional England, in this fight, in the struggle for ideology, the fear was that we would reduce things to the level of propaganda. So that rather than, when I talk to Marina, rather than confronting her as a fellow intellect and reasonable person, I appealed to her passions. So what if I said to her, let's find something we both disagree with and really just harp on it. So maybe if this were World War II, maybe I would show her an image of kind of a monsterized Japanese person. Or if this were the 19th century, maybe I'd show her an Irishman as an ape, which would probably not fit with her red hair, but something something that would...
I'm not Irish.
I figured. It's with your last name. But something like that where my appeal to her is not at a reasonable level, but at an emotional level. And this is what the fear was, that we would start using ideas as a way to convince people, not at their highest level, but at their lowest level. So I would drive the animalistic side of Marina in my attempt. And this is what Hitler does. Now, any of us who go back, and I realize we have to be German speakers, but if you go back and you listen to Hitler, even if it's in German, you can tell the guy has a certain charisma. He obviously had a huge charisma. Lenin was the same way. Mussolini to a lesser extent. But they all had this certain charisma, and they could get crowds worked up very, very easily. But the reason they were able to do that is because they appealed to the lowest aspect. They appealed to the lowest thing that was there. And that's, you know, I don't mean to be too nasty about anyone in particular in the present day, but I fear that just personally when I see things like CNN or Fox and debates on both of those, where the debates are not rational. They're clearly meant to make a score a point. They're not about actually having rational discussion. And that, you know, as much as I despise the politics at NPR, at least at NPR they're polite to one another. And you can actually hear them discussing things, even if there's an edge of propaganda there as well. But that's what these guys were fearful of, that we would turn these things into something that would just make us react emotionally and not rationally or intellectually. So we appeal to something. So we all know there's nothing wrong with images. There's nothing wrong with symbols. But because images and symbols can be so powerful, they can be corrupted very easily. So I'd like you, if you don't mind, let's all turn. We're going to jump ahead here. And for this last section of the course, we're going to be jumping all over the place. It's not really going to be chronological. It'll be more based on ideas. But I'd like you to turn to 735. As we're thinking about what happens with this propaganda. So 735 in your reader is a piece by a very important public intellectual, not someone on the right. So it would be pretty easy to find Lippmann and think, because of what we're going to read here, that he's a libertarian or a conservative. He's not. He's actually fairly pro-New Deal at the beginning and becomes very uncomfortable with it. But he's later in the Kennedy administration. So he's no right-winger, but he's very, very critical of what the left is doing, and he's very critical of what's going on with this rise of ideology. So we would call him a classical liberal, but more of a cross between a classical liberal and a modern liberal. Not quite what we saw in Eclipse of Liberalism, but not a Milton Friedman or a Friedrich Hayek type either, even though he actually likes Hayek a lot. They're pretty good friends, and they talk. But they're going to have a difference here in the way they view things. So someone want to read here, volunteer or I'll volunteer you, right there on the In the Violent Conflicts Which Now Trouble. So, Laurel, thanks.
In the violent conflicts which now trouble the earth, the active contenders believe that since the struggle is so deadly, it must be that the issues which divide them are deep. I think they're mistaken. Because parties are bitterly opposed, it does not necessarily follow that they have radically different purposes. The intensity of their antagonism is no measure of the divergence of their views. There has been many a ferocious quarrel among sectarians who worship the same God. Although the partisans who are now fighting for the mastery of the modern world wear shirts of different colors, their weapons are drawn from the same armory, their doctrines are variations of the same theme, and they go forth to battle singing the same tune with slightly different words. Their weapons are the coercive direction of the life and labor of mankind. Their doctrine is that disorder and misery can be overcome only by more and more compulsory organization. Their promise is that through the power of the state, men can be made happy. Throughout the world, in the name of progress, men who call themselves communists, socialists, fascists, nationalists, progressives, and even liberals are unanimous in holding that government, with its instruments of coercion, must, by commanding the people how they shall live, direct the course of civilization, and fix the shape of things to come.
They believe in what Mr. Stuart Chase accurately describes as the overhead planning and control of economic activity. This is a dogma which all prevailing dogmas presuppose. This is the mold in which they are cast the thought and action of the epoch. No other approach to the regulation of human affairs is seriously considered or is even conceived as possible. The recently enfranchised masses and the leaders of thought who supply their ideas are almost completely under the spell of this dogma. Only a handful here and there, groups without influence, isolated and disregarded thinkers, continue to challenge it. For the premises of authoritarian collectivism have become the working beliefs, the self-evident assumptions, the unquestioned axioms, not only of all the revolutionary regimes, but of nearly every effort which lays claim to being enlightened, humane, and progressive.
All right, let's stop there, Laura. Thank you. So we have this idea here, and I hope this was clear for everyone, that we've narrowed everything down. So it's not that thought is gone. It's that we've limited thought. We've taken one thought and excluded a billion others. So these progressives are generally not liars. They generally are reducers. So they simplify. They take a very complex idea and they only talk about that idea at the exclusion of everything else. So if we look, as he lays this out, he's just brutal in this, and you can imagine the kind of reaction people would have had, even many of his allies, you know, throughout the world. So this is right where Laurel read line 10, right, line 12, right in there. Throughout the world, in the name of progress, men who call themselves communists, socialists, fascists, nationalists, progressives, and liberals are unanimous. So they all hold the same idea. We have to centralize everything through the power of the coercive state. This is how we achieve whatever ends we need. So communism and fascism, though they proclaim to be very different, are in fact not different at all. They're almost identical. As he says right above, and I love his writing, at line 3 and 4 of that page, there have been many a ferocious quarrel among sectarians who worship the same God. And you know, just imagine, yeah, I've been here at Hillsdale now for 19 years. How many times have I heard the same arguments about faith versus good works over those 19 years? And you know, it's a great debate. Don't get me wrong. It's a very, very good debate. But I hear the same debate, and I have for 19 years. Now, Catholics believe this, Protestants believe this. And if you're not Catholic or Protestant, Catholics and Protestants look like there's no difference between them. If you're Catholic, you think you're radically different from Protestant. If you're Protestant, you think you're radically different from Catholic. But if you're on the outside, you all look the same. And that's exactly what he's saying here. Yeah, if you're a fascist, you hate the communists. Of course you do. And if you're a communist, you hate the fascist. But one reason you hate them so much is because they're basically exactly like you with one small variation. And it's that variation that you latch onto and just beat the snot out of each other with that variation. So you may agree 99.9% of the time, but that 0.1% you're ready to die for. And even someone who's not with you at all, because they're not in that fight, they may be radically different from you, but you don't despise them as much because they're not a part of the fight, even though they should be your real enemy because you're so worried about the guy who's just like you, but not quite. So one of the things that Lippmann brings out very importantly, and he has the character to be able to make this stick, is that when we're looking at these rival ideologies, you can say all you want, fascism is right-wing and communism is left-wing. In the end, they're almost identical. What is fascism? What is communism? What is left? What is right? There is a left-right spectrum, and I personally believe this. You don't have to agree with me on this. I don't think there is such a thing as a left-right spectrum. I think it's a trick. I think it's a false manipulation that people have used to get us to move away from what is truly humane and what matters. So rather than us looking at here is fully man and here is degraded man, looking at it in a hierarchical way, we split it and we say, oh, here's man over on the right and here's man on the left. Well, they're both men, and therefore they have far more in common than they don't. And that, so we've made the fight a vertical fight, or horizontal fight, rather than a vertical fight. I think that's incredibly dangerous. And it's very new. No one in the ancient world would have talked about right wing or left wing. So this thing that we do to divide ourselves, I don't think it's accurate, but we do it all the time. So this is left, this is right, and it doesn't really work. But that's what Lippmann is trying to say. And again, I can't say it any better than he does. There have been many a ferocious quarrel among sectarians who worship the same God. And what is this God now? Well, the God's not Christ and it's not Allah. It is progress. That's the new God. The new God is progress. Mussolini wanted progress. Hitler wanted progress. Lenin wanted progress. Woodrow Wilson wanted progress. It's not the same progress, and yet it is. That's what they're really fighting for. So if you look down at the bottom of what he says, and I'm going to bring this, I'll try and bring this back to us right here. But if you look back right where Laurel stopped, line 29 on page 736, so universal is the dominion of this dogma over the minds of contemporary men that no one is taken seriously as a statesman or a theorist who does not come forward with proposals to magnify the power of public officials and to extend and multiply their intervention in human affairs. Now, let's just think about that for a moment. I know it's been a while, but if we go back to the Northwest Ordinance, what do we see? We see that the American founding is based on the idea that we in community have power, not a political institution. We have power in our schools, we have power in our churches, in our families, in our local communities, in our book clubs, we have power in our sororities, our fraternities. That's where our power is. And it was the French who said, no, no, all power should reside in the nation. Well, in the 20th century, the French have won, because nobody takes seriously the idea that our garden club should have power. Instead, we think, all right, how much power do we give to the executive branch or the legislative branch or the judicial branch? We don't think the book club should have any real say in governance anymore. But at the time of the founding, of the American founding, that's exactly what we said. But now everything becomes, how do we concentrate power in politics? So we've politicized everything, and we've concentrated power in the political realm, which I would argue is utterly anti-American. It's also anti-Western, but it's completely anti-American and anti-founding. And I don't think we have to be radicals to see this. Again, just compare what we find in the 20th century to the founding documents. They are fundamentally different. And so if you propose anything, as Lippmann says, that's different than that, well, you're at, as he says, unless one, he, is an authoritarian or a collectivist, he's a mossback. He just collects moss. That's all he's good for. Some guy, stand patter, a reactionary. And so a reactionary is even worse than a mossback. A mossback just stands there and collects moss. But the reactionary is actually fighting against the tide of history. So you're a reactionary, at best an amiable eccentric, swimming hopelessly against the tide, and it is a strong tide. So in the 1930s, if I were to suggest that, well, maybe we should keep power with the Automobile Association or with the local school district, I'm just a fool. At best, if they like me, I'm an eccentric. If they hate me, I'm a reactionary and I'm evil. But regardless, I'm done. There's nothing I can do or say. And, you know, imagine now in 2017, yeah, as someone who's not on the left, I'm in a much, much better position than someone in 1937. In 1936 and 37, I would have been done. My career would have been over. I can at least speak these words now. We all think, especially those of us at Hillsdale, we think the world's gone to hell. It looks nothing in 2017 like it did in 1937. In 37, the world had gone to hell. And it was everywhere. In America, in the Soviet Union, in Nazi Germany. Can you imagine being a J.R.R. Tolkien? Just imagine being a professor at Oxford. Oxford's pretty nice. You look out at the world, and you get to choose between the arrogant Americans, the outrageously brutal Nazis, or the equally brutal communists. That's kind of your choice. And that doesn't look good if you're just a good person trying to figure out what the world is about and trying to imagine. So here's where, and we're going to, I told you guys this would get depressing. It does get depressing. But I want to give you a couple of numbers to recognize what's happening here and how things have changed. So Lippmann doesn't have, he's making an argument based on what he sees, and he's extremely smart, but he doesn't have the evidence. We now have the evidence. We know what was going on in the 20th century. So I want you guys to know these numbers, and this is what your final question on your final exam is about, which you guys already have in the syllabus. But this is the question I want you to think about, or at least one of them that I want you to think about. And that is, how do we look at the rates of death in the 20th century? So death by government, murder by government, by war, what rates do we have? So in these, so I'm not going to do exactly the 20th century. What I'm going to do is about 19, bless you, who was it? That was great, Shiloh. That was a very nice
thank
you. All right. It was a gentle sneeze. All right, so from 1914 up until about 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union. So these, so it's not the full 20th century, but our the numbers we have from 1914 to 1991. Remember, from about 1815 up until 1914, Europe is at relative peace. It still has, you have huge border wars, Germany and Denmark, Germany and France. There's still the Franco-Prussian War. You still have wars, don't get me wrong. But there are no large-scale wars like there were with Napoleon. Once Napoleon's deposed from 1815 up until 1914, Europe is generally at peace, in a relative sense. Europe's never at peace, but in a relative sense, it's at peace. And so there's not a lot going on. We obviously have our horrific civil war in the middle of that. But starting in 1914, truly all hell comes to earth. And once you have this archduke assassinated in Serbia by this crazy terrorist organization, we're still dealing with it. In 2017, we're still dealing with the after effects of that one assassination in 1914. Everything falls apart. Kingdoms fall, empires rise, ideologies take hold. So 1914, we often, historians will talk about this as the first year of our time of troubles, which is poetic but also accurate. So from 1914 to 1999, we know that in that whole time, that roughly 50 million men, soldiers, so it's not just men, but men and women, mostly men, but women as well, soldiers is probably a better way to put it, 50 million are killed. So in organized warfare, soldier versus soldier, it doesn't matter if they were drafted or they volunteered. Most soldiers in the 20th century were drafted, so there aren't very many volunteers. So 50 million died. And that's a huge number. It's one of the largest numbers in world history to see. And, of course, that makes sense when you think about modern warfare and new technology. But here's the number that should just floor us in every way. And that is, all right, so how many people died unnaturally, not by war, but by their own governments exterminating them, whether it was in the Nazi Holocaust camps or in the Soviet Gulag or in the Mexican Gulag in Chihuahua, wherever it was, or the Pol Pot in Cambodia. If we add up all the numbers of governments, fascist and communist, who killed their own citizens, the number is 205 million. Now, just think about that for a minute. Warfare killed 50 million soldiers in the 20th century. That's outrageous. Governments, nation states, killed four times the number that warfare killed. War is horrible, but war is not the greatest killer. Governments are the greatest killer. There's no question about that. The numbers prove that out. And I want you to think about this for a moment. Just think about that number, 205 million. So how many of us can even get that into our heads? I mean, we can see a number, but can you really imagine 205 million people? One scholar estimated that if you had all of them, so let's just say that Shelby and I decide we're going to honor all of the dead, and we're going to have a wake, and so we're going to let them all walk past us, right? All the ghosts, they'll walk past us, all the dead. And if we just stood there and honored them, and if they walked at a normal human pace, and they were about 2 feet apart from each other, so just a line, it would take 5.5 years for them all to walk by us. 24 hours a day, nonstop. 5.5 years. Now, just... the numbers are mind-boggling. If we think about a mass murder like Ted Bundy, 17 people in his freezer. Okay, it's disgusting, of course, it's horrific. We can imagine it. We can think of 17 people. It's not good, but we can imagine, right? One's enough, one's too much. We can imagine that. But you start saying 205 million, and what do you do with that? Our brains are not capable of handling that. If we started thinking about, okay, well, who did all of this? Well, the greatest killer of the 20th century, by far, was the Soviet Union. Soviet Union killed about 62 million of its own people during that time. That they're not killing the enemy, they're killing their own people. That's astounding. Right? Hitler, the whole Holocaust camp system, which is the Holocaust, the camps that existed from the moment Hitler comes to power, but the mass killings started in 1942. So up until 1942, if you're in the Holocaust camp, chances are you might work to death, but they're just labor camps. When I say just, I don't mean like, oh yeah, this is fun, let's do that. That's not what I mean. But they're not the, here's the mass gas chamber, walk in and we're killing 1,000 people at a moment. It's not, that all starts in 42 and it lasts. So into 42 up until 45, where you have those mass killings. But during those mass killings, during the Holocaust camps, Hitler kills 21 million. So we all know, every one of us knows 6 million Jews. But we often forget 15 million Lutherans and Catholics who were also killed in those Holocaust camps, mostly Poles and Eastern Europeans, but all civilians who were massacred too. So now just imagine, Hitler might get an award for the most killings in the shortest amount of time, but of course he stopped. So when he puts a bullet in his head in 1945, his killings, obviously, that's his last death, is his own. So he's over. Soviets don't stop killing, even when we have a better Soviet leader under Gorbachev. He's still killing people in the gulag. No, that's not ending. I mean, Putin, as bad as he is, makes these guys... You know, he looks like a Boy Scout next to all of these guys, even though he was KGB. What he's doing now, he's throwing a lot of people in prison. He's not executing people in mass like even Gorbachev was. And I, believe me, I'm no fan of Putin at all. Guy's scum. But he's bad scum versus total evil scum. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about people like Hitler or Stalin or Lenin. So the same thing is true in China. In China, we have under Mao Zedong, we have probably close to the same number that the Soviets killed. And we often think, well, Taiwan is the good China. Well, Taiwan, the Republic of China, it is the good China today. But when it was founded, Chiang Kai-shek, its ruler, had about 10 million of his own people killed. So in comparison, 10 million versus 62 million, that's no big deal. But 10 million, just think about that for a moment. Our ally, Chiang Kai-shek, killed 10 million civilians. And when I say kill them, I don't mean just throwing them in a gas chamber where they're dead. I mean taking them from their children, sometimes ripping off limbs before killing them and torturing them, sometimes just a bullet in the head. That you're lucky if you get the bullet in the head. But this is what life was like. So imagine, I'll get you in a second, Kathleen, but just imagine for a moment. So let me put this in perspective. 205 million people dead in that short time period. Never in the world, never have we seen anything like this. If you take all the people killed by their own governments throughout all of history up until 1914, you're at roughly 110 million, which is still horrible, but nothing compared to 205 in this 80-year period in the 20th century. But just imagine, so America right now, I didn't check it this morning, but America's population is roughly about 330 million right now. So 205, that would be, imagine every 2 out of 3 people you know murdered. Imagine the American population being cut down, 2/3 of it gone almost instantaneously. So only 1 out of every 3 people you know is alive. That's what happened in the 20th century. So we take for granted, I grew up in a very idyllic town in central Kansas. You know, I never saw any of this stuff. But most of the world lived through this. So if you're a good person in 1937, and you happen to live in a good country, the world just, how could you not expect it to end tomorrow? And this is just horrible. If it's 1950, the Soviets have taken over about half of the world in 1950. So you've got about half the world that's free, which means either they're free or they're living under a dictator who doesn't like the Soviet Union. They're still not free. It's a place like Chile or Argentina. It's still pretty brutal and pretty bad, but it's nothing compared to the Nazis. So it's a better kind of tyranny, but it's still tyranny. And we in America, we just take this for granted, but we were the freest people. Without question, we were the freest people in the 20th century. We're not right now, but we were in the 20th century. And the world was just hell. So this is where you guys, we're all, you're in a chaotic situation. You're 20, you're looking at the world, and the world is chaos. There, it was organized terror. And in some ways, it's better because you know who the enemy is. It's harder to engage the enemy today. You know, if we would have torn apart a Nazi stronghold like what we did to Syria this weekend, we would all, of course, the Nazis are just unbelievably evil. No one's going to feel guilty. We might feel guilty if civilians were killed, like in Dresden. But if we hit some Nazi base, no one's going to care. But think about this. We hit a Syrian base. None of us are totally sure if those were our allies or our enemies. Just look at the news. We don't know. We know that our president acted. He hit hard, really hard. We know a lot of civilians were killed. But not one of us can judge just breezily and say, oh yeah, those were Nazis. Well, probably a lot of bad guys did die in that, but probably a lot of good guys died too. So it's just not clear cut. It's not as brutal, but it's also not as clear cut. So this was organized hell. What you guys have is chaotic hell. So it's different, but there's good and bad to both. Does that make sense? I mean, none of it's good, but you understand in a relative sense.
Catherine. I was going to ask where the rest of them came from, but
the rest of the deaths?
The rest of the deaths.
Yeah, so I'm adding up. Those are any government, whatever you want to call it, left-wing, right-wing, any government that kills its own citizens are lumped in there. So the biggest ones are China, the Soviet Union, and Nazi Germany. But then you have others, North Korea, very deadly, but we don't know the numbers there because nobody can get into the archives. And very interesting, you guys, this is all when I was just right in grad school. The Soviet Union fell in 1991. It was my first year of grad school. 1991 was my first year. And so the Soviet Union fell, and there was a period of 4 years where the Russians let us look in the archives. And then 1995, they shut them all down again. Nobody can go into the Russian archives today. So there were 4 years where scholars could go in and start calculating a lot of this stuff. That's how we ended up. That's why we've got the Mises papers here, because the Soviets had captured those from the Nazis. It was that four-year period where, and of course we didn't know it was going to close, but people still, so all the information we have, and the Soviets kept they were very proud of who they killed. They're very proud of it. They have very detailed records of who they murdered. And the Nazis, even more so, the Nazis were, yeah, they gloried in it. So the Soviets were at least slightly, well, they were proud, but not as, they didn't glory in it like the Nazis did. But they're just as bad. So anyway, we just had that short period. But yeah, essentially we can say almost every one of these regimes was either some form of communism or some form of fascism. Not always. We can throw the British in because of what they did in South Africa, and they had a few concentration camps as well. If we added the Indians in for us, but that's an earlier century, yeah, we'd have some bad numbers too. In the 20th century, the Americans were not wholesale killing anyone. So we kind of got off a little easily, more easily than we probably should have. But yeah, good. Anybody else on this? Yes, Nicole.
Did the fall of the Soviet Union really mark a significant end of this era, and like governments that are killing many people today, is that driven by different ideologies?
Yeah, so what, that's a great question, Nicole. What you have, and we'll get into this as we go through the semester, well, our 3 weeks left, right? We'll see all this. But what we find, and this is what I don't want to sound flippant here at all, because it was terrible, but this is the kind of thing I was trying to answer with Catherine, that the only thing that really changes is the systematic killing becomes chaotic killing. So whereas before you had organized states committing mass genocide, it's not genocide actually. Genocide means you're wiping out an entire group of people. The proper term is called democide rather than genocide, meaning you target a specific group of people rather than an entire like race. So democide is the more proper, demo meaning people, right? Demos. Democide, democracy. So that's the proper term. But the only thing that changes is it becomes chaotic and uncontrolled rather than systematic and controlled. So there's a pattern, and we will talk about this, but one of the reasons the Soviets fell is because they did get into a pattern. So once they're in a pattern, you can, and this is hilarious, and we'll talk about all this later, but the great person who helped bring down the Soviets was the Polish bishop, Karol Wojtyla, who later became John Paul II, and he was named bishop in 1958. He had been a member of the anti-Nazi underground and then a member of the anti-communist underground. He had also been part of the Salvation of Jews League, and he'd done some. He carried one if I remember right, a paraplegic Jewish woman on his back 200 miles to get her out of Poland. The stories are unbelievable, like just beyond heroism, just crazy. And he's not alone, and this is happening all over Eastern Europe. But one of the things that John Paul recognized right away was that the Soviets were preachers of, they're conservative. They're preachers of constant, they just do the same thing over and over again, even in their arrests. They don't have a rule of law, but they have a pattern. So here's an arrest, they take you to the gulag, and you can kind of predict. So what John Paul did, and I realize not all of you are Catholics, but it is hilarious, and especially if you're Catholic, it makes it even funnier. But what he would do, every time the Soviets would have, in Poland at least, they would have an official, today's International Communist Day, and everybody gets off work, and we're going to celebrate communism. He would say, oh no, today is the feast of Saint whatever. And in fact, they can't go celebrate, they have to come to Mass. And so he'd clog up the roads. And that the point wasn't to get people to Mass, it was to create confusion. So he would just call a holy day, and then you'd have the whole roads clogged, and the Poles couldn't meet for their communism. And he just did this all the time. And they tried to kill him. In 1981, they hired a Bulgarian assassin to kill him. And, of course, the bullet missed his heart by a millimeter. But we'll get into all that later. But they knew this guy was deadly. He's the nicest guy in the world. That's why they hated him. And they wanted him dead. They wanted Reagan dead, too. But we'll get into all that. So, yeah. Let me just put it this way. For all the depressing stuff we'll talk about, we're going to meet the coolest people in world history. Reagan's one of them. These guys, they're just incredible. So, yeah, we'll talk about them. Okay, so anything else on this? Okay, well, let me mention, we've got about 2 minutes left, and since I'm behind on things, let me push this forward just a little bit. And that is, we have to figure out, so let's just imagine us. For our remaining 2 minutes, let's just put us at a time period. Let's say that this is, what is today, April what?
10th.
Okay, so we'll make this April 10th, 1929. All right, so here it is, April 10th, 1929. We're at Hillsdale. Great liberal arts college. We have the same gender distribution we have now. So here we are at college, and let's say that I just asked you, 1929. All right, at Hillsdale, I ask you, what's it mean to be an American? Most of you would not be able to answer me. You could now, in 2017. You could pull out your pocket constitution signed by Dr. Arne. You could do all kinds of things. But in 1929... there's kind of one thing left that we still believe in. Religion's kind of out the window. Hardly anybody's religious anymore, except for a few crazies in the South. And they're not really crazy, but that's how they're perceived. We're not fascists. We're not communists. We might say we're capitalists. And even that we would be a little uncomfortable with. But then imagine we get to October of 1929. Everything collapses. And even those of us who are diehard libertarians, we don't know how to explain 1929 right then. We can later, but we can't right then. So you guys, let's just pretend you're all right where you are. We look out at the world. You're either a fascist or a communist. Nobody looks like us, really, except for the British. They're kind of snobby, and you know, we're getting along with them okay, but we're not really in any great international situation. And then the one thing we believe in, when you guys come back in the fall, it all falls apart. This is crazy. And one of the things I would suggest, very importantly, and I think yeah, this is partly Brad, it's partly Hillsdale, it's partly just as a historian, we do have to believe in something. People who don't believe in something do very dangerous things. People who believe in something that's wrong do even more dangerous things. But people who believe in something that's right do great things. And part of the problem in 1929, which will last all the way up until about the 1970s, Americans don't really know who they are. So even in the Korean War, people will get captured in prison of war camps, and the communists will start torturing Americans, and they'll say, just tell us what you believe. Americans can't answer. They don't know what they believe. I'm American. What's that mean? I don't know. They just don't have a clue. And that's the danger here. So it's terrible to believe in something that's evil. It's really bad to believe in something that doesn't exist or not to believe in anything at all, too. And that's where we find ourselves in a place like 1929. So the problem with the fascists and the communists, they actually believe in what they're doing. They're not lying. They believe it. And that's hard to be when someone really believes it. Okay, sorry to take you guys over. But thank you. Good class. Make sure, well, no, I'm not going to have you, we're going to read together. So no readings for Wednesday. Just come with your book. And, you know, like I said, make sure you look, you guys all look great. Look like we look today. So thank you. Oh, yeah. I am really.